The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Miriam Spector. I'm a member of the Free Library Foundation Board and chair of the George S. Pepper Society Council. As some of you may know, the Free Library is currently working very hard to match a very generous gift of $15 million, anonymous, a challenge gift to the Central Library Expansion Project. It's a transformational endeavor which will not only bring you increased comfort in a new state-of-the-art auditorium, but will also provide all the members of our Philadelphia community with a much-needed, creative, and cutting-edge information center that is free and accessible to everyone. As our library card says, exercise your freedom to be informed. And if you don't have a library card, may I suggest that you sign up for one in the lobby after Dr. Gottlieb's presentation. All private gifts made to the Central Library Expansion Project through May 31st will be matched dollar for dollar. So if ever there was a time for you to participate in this important cause, it's now. Please let any of us know if you would like to be a part of that excitement. I am requesting now that you silence your cell phones, and I'd also like to remind you that after his presentation, Dr. Gottlieb will take some questions, and then we'll be happy to greet you upstairs where his two books will be for sale. A practicing psychologist and family therapist in the Philadelphia area for more than 30 years, Dr. Daniel Gottlieb is the host of Voices in the Family, an award-winning mental health call-in radio show on WHYY. He also writes a bi-monthly column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dr. Gottlieb's first book, which he discussed at our Pickwick Salon here at the library, called Letters to Sam, is a poignant group of letters that he has written to his grandson, Sam. In his new book, Learning from the Heart, he examines what divides and unites us all, including the problems of family life, the issues of injustice and arbitrariness that affect the way we understand the world and the way we live our lives. The book is concerned with our battered souls and what it means to be human. With calmness and gravity, humor and self-deprecation, Dr. Gottlieb gave me the encouragement to train my soul to be at peace, as his is. Dr. Gottlieb will be interviewed by Mike and Scott, producer of Voices in the Family at WHYY, and content producer for Dr. Gottlieb's National Public Television debut, which she will tell you about. And Mike and Dan, when you come out, I do hope that you will discuss my favorite quote in the book from Gandhi, "Love is the prerogative of the brave." We are honored to have them both with us here today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mike and Scott and Dr. Dan Gottlieb.
Thank you.
This will work. We've got the trick mics on today.
Sandy.
Do you have your water where you can reach it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have
yeah.
your water? Okay. Hello, everybody. We're going to start with just talking a little bit, Dan and I, and then Dan will read from his new book. And then we want to open things up to you in the audience. So if you have any questions for Dan, you can answer them toward the end. you can ask them, and Dan will answer them. Dan, let's start with love. We just heard the quote from Gandhi, and why did you choose to start your book with love?
I said to somebody a couple of months ago that I think the trick with happiness is loving who you love, loving them better, expanding that list of who you love, love them more altruistically, more open-heartedly, and everything else is details after that.
But love can also bring a lot of unhappiness into the lives of people. A lot of anxiety, a lot of worry relates to those we love.
I didn't know that. Love is the prerogative of the brave. That quote that gets attributed to Gandhi. I was saying backstage, truth be known, he got it from me, but he's a good guy, so I gave him the credit for it. True love requires us to be open-hearted, requires us to expect nothing, to demand nothing, to love for the sake of love, to simply have the heartfelt wish that those we love have a life of happiness and peace. Happiness as defined by them and not us. Now, you know, I talk in the book, we all experience that when we see a child for the first time, our child for the first time, that kind of open-hearted, pure love and desire just for their welfare. And then in about 15 seconds, our mind starts to think, oh my God, I'm responsible for this kid. You know, and oh my God, what if? And it's understandable. I mean, our species would not be here if it weren't for that. But it is that anxiety that can interfere with the pure, heartfelt love I talked about. And I see in families, I see in the larger culture, that we worry so much about those we love that we can't feel the love anymore. We can only feel the anxiety. Let me read from my chapter on love. Yeah. My microphone squeaks. Must be about the same age I am. I squeak. So I'll read a little bit. Okay, have a minute? I quote Coral Menninger here, where he says, love cures people, both the ones who give and the ones who receive. In the movie Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood, the father, played by James Garner, is walking along with his daughter, played by Sandra Bullock, when she confronts him with the question, Daddy, were you loved enough in your life? Her words express the unmet wishes of a child. In the movie, her mother is portrayed as a character who's overly emotional and self-absorbed. Though the mother gets married and has a child, she's not able to love her daughter properly. And the young girl carries the burden. The daughter's angry and resentful, resulting from the deprivation of love, which makes her question so poignant. As for the father, in the movie, it's apparent he wasn't loved enough. Yet, there he is walking along side by side with his daughter, who he loves dearly. It's clear that he's happy. It's a Hollywood cliche. But what occurred to me was that his daughter asked the wrong question. It isn't whether he was loved enough. The question should be, Daddy, did you love enough? It doesn't matter which direction the love goes. I said, I think the Beatles got it wrong when they said love is all you need. But Andrew Lloyd Webber got it right when he said love changes everything, whether it's love given and received or promised and betrayed. Whichever way you examine it, love changes everything. And no love is more profound than pure, open-hearted, selfless love. Let me skip ahead. Stephen Post, who we've had on our show, he's president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love at Case Western Reserve University. Cool job. He describes altruistic love as love for all humanity without exception, with abiding kindness and service. This love is a selfless act of generosity and spirit. And sometimes it's a state of being. It's not loving for or even loving with. It's being love. That's why I opened the book.
But then the way we love others is usually not a conscious decision. Love happens. We fall in love. We love our family. We love our friends. You talk a lot in your book and in your work about checking in with yourself. So when that anxiety comes in, that worry, when maybe you lose that love because you're so worried about the other person, how do you check in with yourself to kind of get a grip on that or to rethink how you feel about a person, a family member, a friend?
We're going to talk later about a TV special I recently did that's going to be rebroadcast. But one of the things I said on that, I talk a good deal about the heart metaphorically and the heart literally. And I began thinking of it this way when I read a quote by Victor Hugo in Les Mis. And in this quote, he said, "In darkness, the pupil dilates as though searching for light. And in adversity, the heart dilates as though searching for God." And I thought that imagery of the dilated heart, the aching, pure, wide-open heart, was such powerful imagery, it stayed with me. And it's in the dilated heart, and only in the dilated heart, that we're able to experience love and joy and serenity and security and all those things we ache for as humans. It's in the dilated heart. So there I was about 5 years ago doing grand rounds at Abington Hospital, and I offered this quote. And one of the surgeons in the back raises his hand, and he says, "Yeah, but," as many surgeons will. "Yeah, but," he said, "that might work well metaphorically," said, "but the organ can't stay dilated. You would die. It has to open and close to sustain life." And I said, "And so too the metaphorical heart. When we're injured, when we're hurt, when we're scared, the heart has to close. It's what we do. It's how we survive. But what I ask," and this gets back to the special, "is to just know when your heart's closed." And I'm asking a lot, because in order to do that, you have to check in with yourself, with your heart. You could probably feel it right now, whether your heart feels open or closed. There's no right or wrong here. There's no good or bad way to be. But just check in. And when your heart's closed, you're in pain. There's some sense of threat in your life. Might be small, might be beyond consciousness. But when your heart's closed, you're not at peace. And when your heart's closed, you need care. That's all. So we have this mind that tricks us into thinking, well, we've got this child, and they're only getting C's in school. Heaven forbid. So I worry about that child because they won't get into the best school they can. Heaven forbid. So I worry about that child, and I worry about that child now all the time. And my heart's closed because I worry so much. But our minds think that the reason our hearts are closed is because our child's getting C's. So if we can push our child to get A's and B's, then we'll feel better and then our hearts will be open. Doesn't work that way. It hasn't worked so far for you that way, I'm sure, if you're anything like me. When your heart's closed, know that your heart's closed, and what you need is care and compassion and understanding and tenderness. You don't need your kid to get an A to take care of your heart. So love is easy, and yeah, pop psychology is right. Maybe it does have to start with you. Maybe compassion for your closed heart makes it easier to love others.
I want to talk about children a bit, because you talk a lot about the kind of role models that children have in today's world, and that's something that worries you a great deal. Talk a little bit about that.
Just as I was getting the
camera. Right.
I talk to kids a lot. I wrote one of my letters in Letters to Sam. I told Sam about a group of high school kids I had spoken to who were under a great deal of stress. They were applying to colleges, upper school kids, under enormous stress. And by the way, all kids I speak to are under enormous stress. Whether you might think they have reason or not, these kids are under much more stress than we ever were. So I talked to these kids about what their stress was about, and they said, so we can get into the right college. Oh. Why? So we can get the best grades we can, so that we can get a head start in life or into the best graduate school. Why? So we can really launch our career and, you know, be on top of things. Why? So we can be happy. Oh. So what is that? What is happiness? And I got all the answers you'd expect from 16, 17, 18-year-old kids. If I had $1 million in the bank, case of beer in the refrigerator. One girl said, if I was number one in my chosen profession, I'd be happy. I wouldn't be happy with number two. All the answers you'd expect. And then driving home, I realized what I didn't hear. I didn't hear anything about love, family, children, community. There were some 300 kids there, tomorrow's leaders, and not one talked about these things. I wouldn't have gotten that 10, 15 years ago. So what are these kids seeing when they're looking at the world around them, in their parents, what they're seeing are role models for tenacity, for hard work, for self-sacrifice, for deprivation. And you know what? They're looking at their future through our eyes. It doesn't look so good. It doesn't look pretty. And one of the most uncomfortable questions I ask adults in an audience is, how would you like your children to be living the life you're living now? People are uncomfortable with that question because the answer is no. And the question I have to ask after that is, so why are you living the life you're living now if you wouldn't want that for your children? The role models our children don't have. They got role models for tenacity and hard work and self-sacrifice. And they've got role models for the pursuit of pleasure all over TV and the Internet. So they know how to pursue pleasure. And they know about self-sacrifice. But they've got no role models for true joy and happiness and self-care. They've got no role models for a vision of serenity and peacefulness. And I think that is our responsibility to our children, to be that kind of role model. And it's our responsibility to ourselves, too. We have a life. We have to honor it and care for it. It's precious.
Another...
Can I answer your question? I forgot what it was. You forgot too?
No. You talk a lot about spending time with your friends, with your kids, and listening is a big theme in this book. And recently we did a radio show which was entitled Tell Me Your Story. And you offered people to send them bumper stickers that said, tell me your story. And I think we sent out about 2,000 of those bumper stickers. So it was definitely a theme that people were interested in. Why is listening so important? And what was that whole tell me your story idea about?
Well, I can answer it theoretically and I can answer it personally. And by the way, the tell me your story started off with a column I wrote, and I said, I've got four words that can change the world. It can diminish global conflict. It can diminish divorce and malpractice suits. Four words. Tell me your story. And then just listen and try to imagine that that story is your story. Four words. So, you know, my daughter, for I think it was Father's Day or something, gave me 250 bumper stickers that said, tell me your story. I have one on my van. And so I offered it, you know, send me a self-addressed stamped envelope. And it must have been 1,000 people requested. Our poor associate producer folded so many bumper stickers that they actually tried to assault me in the parking lot. So why? Why is this important and why does it work? The psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott said that a human psyche, an infant psyche, is like a bubble in water. And if the pressure in the water is too high, too much attention, too much focus, too much anxiety, or if it's too low, neglect, then the pressure's not right and that bubble won't be healthy, that psyche. It'll always be focused on the outside, trying to take care of the environment. And many of us here in the room can relate to that, right? Spend our emotional lives and energy trying to take care of the environment so that we can feel better. So what is that really? Well, what that is really is us never having had the chance to find out who we are, never being in an environment where someone was interested in finding out who we are. And that came home to roost for me after the accident. And this experience I'm about to tell you was some of the impetus for writing the book. I felt different from the rest of my species. Everyone looked at me differently and talked to me differently. Best friends, loved ones, parents. It was different. And I looked different than everyone else. And I wondered, am I still one of them? Nobody else in my environment needed wheelchairs or medications or nurses or catheters. And if I didn't have them, I would have died. And I wondered, am I still fully human? I knew I was different. I began to compulsively report to whoever was listening my internal experience. And Darrell Sifford, I don't know if any of you remember him, he used to be a columnist at the Inquirer, came to my hospital room in March of 1980. This is 2 months after my accident. And in effect, he said those four words to me, tell me your story. And that was the beginning of my feeling that I had a story that was worth listening to, that I had a voice. I've been grateful to him ever since. But that's the beginning of my insight into how important it is to be able to tell our story to someone who cares. And it doesn't matter what the story is, but the longer we listen to somebody else, the more readily we will know other, and the more readily we'll know ourselves. I've always believed that if you look in someone's eyes deeply enough, you'll see their soul. And if you stay there, you'll find your own. And neither of you will ever be the same again.
The book and the TV special that we recently produced, which is of the same title, we talked about kind of some take-home points that boil down the message of your book. And I found them to be really helpful, and I was wondering if you could repeat them for this audience. And if you can't remember them all, I can.
Maiken is my dear friend. She is my producer, and she is my memory. And I also want to say that I was very happy with that special. But when Maiken saw the rehearsal, she started to nag me about take-home points at the end. And I'm not a take-home points kind of guy, you know. I'm a big-picture kind of guy. And she really got on my nerves, but predictably, she was right and I was wrong, which really annoys me. So here were the take-home points. I mean, one of the messages I said was, I started off the show talking about Sam, my grandson, who's on the autism spectrum. And one incident where he was running through, I forget, what are those real tall plants?
Bamboo.
Bamboo shoots, thank you. And, you know, these things grow 15, 20 feet high. And he's running through them with his father, and all of a sudden he stops dead in his tracks, and he turns to his father and he says, Daddy, look at how little we are. Now, the emotion there is awe. he was experiencing awe. All little children experience awe. And we long to experience awe as adults. What happens to that? What happens to Sam's ability to experience awe to these high school students I spoke to that don't know what happiness is? And by the way, that starts to dissipate now around 8, 9 years old. Kids start building their resumes for their future around 8, 9 years old, and they don't feel awe anymore. And we all ache for it. We all long for it. So part of the problem is we rush through our lives so fast that we don't have time to experience our lives. When I asked you earlier just to check in and see if your hearts are open or closed, that was kind of a new experience. You didn't notice that before I asked you to. We don't notice our lives because they go so fast. And people who do notice their lives are the ones like Andrea, who we interviewed on the special, and others who have faced death or who are living with death nearby. Then you can feel your life. Then you feel your breath. You know, your heart's beating. You spend more time with those you love and less time worrying about dirty dishes or socks on the floor or grades. So one of the take-home messages was to stop and breathe. Just feel your breath. You know, in the Bible, the last thing God did before, you know, he kicked back and took a day off was he gave Adam breath. I mean, no matter what your religious beliefs, every time you inhale, it's divine inspiration. And every time we exhale, we expire. And each breath is different. And we don't notice it. So one of the take-home messages is just to notice your breath. Check in. Feel yourself breathing. Notice whether your heart's open or closed. Notice whatever emotion you're feeling at the moment and feel it. It doesn't have to be good or bad or peaceful. Just feel what you feel. The other take-home message is have dinner. Eat. Our kids aren't eating, and their parents aren't eating, and to eat together, the research about what happens in families where you have dinner together 3 times a week or more, the kids are 70% less likely to use drugs. Infants talk at earlier ages. Kids are much less likely to have friends who use drugs. I mean, the research is breathtaking. Have dinner. This is not complicated. Have dinner 3 times a week. It is more important than all of the other crap that you're busy with. Have dinner. The other thing I said was hang out. It's important to hang out. How many of you, when somebody asks how you are, you say, I'm hanging in there? No, hanging in there is kind of like gallows humor, you know. You need to be hanging out. You need to be hanging out. Hang out. Just hang out with your kids, with your loved ones. Hang out with your books, your plants, whatever you want to hang out with. Just hang out. Don't be productive. Just hang out. You need that to heal yourself. The other thing I said was, and I wrote about this in the new book, The 11th Commandment, And the 11th commandment is based on Mel Brooks' movie, History of the World, Part 1. I don't even want to think about how old that movie was. But in this movie, Mel Brooks is playing Moses, and he's coming down the mount with three tablets. And he says, God has given us 15. And then he steps on a rock and drops one of the tablets, and he says, no, 10. God has given us 10 commandments. And, you know, I'm watching the movie, and it filters through Dan's mind, and I'm thinking, I wonder what those other five commandments are. And I've convinced myself that the 11th was, thou shalt not take thyself too seriously. Because we suffer when we do. The late Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin used to say, the cemetery is filled with people who were indispensable. You're not that important. You're not. And your stuff is that important either. And that's a path to well-being. And, you know, I talked about love. And the other thing I talked about is the greater good. And, you know, when I talk to therapists about this, I say the path to mental health is through the pursuit of social health. Now, we can't be sitting in an office talking about our problems and talking through them and become healthy unless some of our time, energy, passion, and compassion is devoted to the greater good. The message is simple. You know, you ferret down the messages from most any Bible, Jesus, the Buddha, Mother Teresa. The message is simple. Feed the hungry. When in doubt, feed the hungry. And everything else is details. Mm-hmm. So, breathe. Have dinner. Don't take yourself too seriously. Love who you love and feed the hungry.
Be involved in your larger community.
Yeah. Simple. Impossible.
Yes. You said the other night it's simple but impossible. But let's open this up to questions from the audience. So if you have a question, just raise your hand and somebody will come over with a microphone to you.
There's one in the back.
All the way in the back. Or do you want people to step up? I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's a right. Gentleman in the back. Lady in the...
Good morning, Dr. Godley. Morning. I've been studying the culture of Americans and the different Hebrew writings and the different Aramaic writings. As an American, all I can do is say have faith in God. As an African American and being through so much in life, all I can say is have faith in God no matter what they do to you, and then you can win.
Thank you. I've got a chapter in here about faith, and faith is important in healing. It's, it's important. It's not essential, but it helps. But I talk about faith in the literal sense. That not necessarily faith in a God necessarily, but faith in the literal sense. And if you think about, you know, I'd struggled for years to define what faith is. And I thought back to when I first learned to float. Now, when you're treading water is one thing. And what happens when you stop treading water? You sink, or you float, right? And what's the difference? Faith. It's faith. It's the act of letting go, of trusting something that is beyond logic, because it doesn't make sense to most of us. Help. Water can keep us afloat. but it's having faith in something that we don't know. It's giving up control. And that's faith. Because, you know, our willpower is not going to get us very far in life. Faith helps. Faith in the larger universe, faith in our own resilience, faith in the resilience and mental health of those we love. Faith.
It's hard. It's really hard.
There's a question in the middle. Wait a minute.
I was at the Family Institute the night of your accident, and I just want to acknowledge you for all you've contributed to people with handicaps, and just you've pointed out so many poignant things, and I'm just very touched to be here today and listening to your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, she was at the Family Institute. The Family Institute of Philadelphia was a place I got my family therapy training in 1970. And right before my accident, I think I was on the board of directors or vice president, and this lady said that that she was there the night of my accident. I wish I was there. Now, I'm not so sure I do. I'm not so sure I do. I'm happy. Who knows what goes into it or how changing the formula would have changed it. Another question?
Yes, Dan, at the beginning you talked about pure, open-hearted love. And I'm wondering how you put that with the idea of a person knowing their own dreams and sort of trying to figure out how to go after those dreams, know what your limits are and so forth, loving yourself at the same time that you're doing pure, unlimited, open-hearted love for another.
Not clear. You say a little more because I'm not getting it.
I think there's some, I'm a little confused about how, if you spent all of your time loving other people, which what I would love to do, and being unlimited about it, is there a way that people can lose themselves and their own dreams, if they leave themselves out of the picture?
I think that's impossible to do. How can you love the larger world and not yourself? I mean, you're part of the larger world. The Dalai Lama, when he first came to this country, gets attributed with saying the thing that shocked him when he first came to the West, he said, people don't seem to like themselves very much over there. He said, how can you not like yourself when you have a Buddha nature inside, and when you have a piece of you that truly is divine? How can you not love yourself? And so you can't be compassionate towards the larger world, towards all living beings, if you're not compassionate towards yourself. Now, we know, I don't even know if this label is still valid about codependency, where, you know, where it's all about self-sacrifice in the hopes that there will be a payoff around the corner. And that payoff doesn't come, and it's just a setup for hurt and deprivation. But I'm talking about love. I'm not talking about self-sacrifice. They look the same, but they're really opposites.
But how do you strike a balance? Let's say if we're talking about a situation where somebody is a caregiver. Many, many people in America are caregivers. So you have somebody who is dependent on you, and you love them, and you want to help them. At the same time, you have needs that may feel selfish compared to the needs of the other person. So I think the danger of losing yourself or losing your own dream, because your dreams may seem selfish compared to what the other person needs. I think a lot of people struggle with finding that balance of being a parent, maybe at the same time being a caregiver, and still taking care of themselves. So how do you, again, check in with yourself?
My only currency is words. I remember when my wife was my caregiver, and she was self-sacrificing, and I hated the fact that I was causing her harm, and I hated the fact that I was scared of doing it any other way. So I hated her for depriving the woman I loved of a life, and I hated me for doing it. And in hindsight, we were both too scared and vulnerable to talk about it. But to open it up and talk about it. To caregivers, your needs are not less important simply because you're able to get up and walk around or because you're not the one who's dying. Your needs are just as important as anybody else's in that room. And for those of us who have been in the position of receiving care, it is an honor to be able to give care to those who care for us. Healing. Yes, in the back.
Dr. Gottlieb, I'm a wife, a mother of six, a grandmother of 12. I've been taking care of two of my grandchildren. The young man's 14 months old, he's 14 years old now, and my granddaughter is 12, and she was 3. I saw something on a church bulletin one time that really inspired me. And I read it, my granddaughter read it. It says, aspire to inspire before you expire. And my granddaughter said, Babci, I'm Polish, I don't understand that. And I said, well, when people get older, they learn a lot of things, and some people don't want to learn from them because they don't think they know anything. Oh, she says, but we think that you know everything, and that's what you're doing for us. I'm a lucky grandmom.
Yeah, you sure are.
I said I had 6 children. My children were taught that God says, love one another, and you're not allowed to hate. And the first time I heard one son say to the other one, I hate you. And I said, no, no, you can tell him you don't like him, but you're never allowed to hate. And that's what they grew up with, and that's what my grandchildren are growing up. God says, love one another.
Yeah, I heard James Carville give a lecture several years ago, and he said, in his own way, he said, people complain about sound bites. He says, I don't think they're that bad. He says, you know, love thy neighbor. That's a sound bite. Seems to work, you know.
Anybody else? I'm a great fan of yours, and it's a pleasure to be here today. You talked a great deal about the importance of faith and love, but the faith part, how does that fit into your relationship with your grandson, Sam?
Sam and I just had a conversation this summer. I referred to it in the newspaper. I'd been quite ill for the last 6 months. And my kids were worried about me. A lot of people were worried about me. So Sam pulls me aside, and I can see he's uncomfortable. And he doesn't know if he's asking a wrong question because his social skills aren't good because he's on the autism spectrum. He says, Pop, he says, how old am I going to be when you die? And I said, I don't know, but what are you worried about? So he says, well, you know, when you die, you won't be there, and I'll miss you, and I'll be really sad. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, what do you think's going to happen to me after I die? So he described a 7-year-old version of heaven. So I said, well, Sam, if I'm in heaven, do you think I'll still love you? And he said, yeah, yeah. And I said, will you still love me? And he said, yeah. And I said, do you think that you will be able to feel me loving you? I thought about that for a long time. I said, yeah, I think I will. So he said, so we got that going for us, huh? So I hope that answers your question. It was a powerful and wonderful discussion with Sam.
I have a couple of take-homes. I've always believed that either, you know, that faith and fear are opposite sides of the same coin. So if you're fearful, you're not faithful. And if you're faithful, you're not fearful. The second take-home is that I try very hard when I'm in a grocery store or a hardware store or something, to look the person in the eye that's serving me and say thank you with my eyes. And you would be amazed at the response that comes back from the faces of the people that do that too. Mm. It's a very simple take home. The third thing is, I'm a retired psychologist, and I want to thank you for the human way in which you convey psychology, for the humility, for the humor, and for the caring. It doesn't come out a lot with a lot of psychologists, and you do it beautifully.
Thank you. Thank you. You won't be surprised to hear that I did terribly in school. Because my mind, you know, I have a simple mind, you know. It's these take on, you know, stop, breathe, love, you know, it's. And that doesn't work well in school.
Okay.
Simple minds. But thank you. I want to say something about eye contact that you talk about. There's a wonderful parable, Jewish teaching. When a rabbi asks his students, there's a prayer that the Orthodox are supposed to say right when the sun comes up. Because the Orthodox have to say prayers when anything happens. So the rabbi says to the students, well, how do you know when it's time to say this prayer? How do you know when the sun's coming up? And one student raises his hand and says, when you can tell the difference between a fig tree and a pear tree. The rabbi says, no. And another student says, when you can look in the distance and see the difference between a goat and a sheep. The rabbi says, no. And the kids get frustrated. So the rabbi says, when you can look in the distance and see the eyes of a man or a woman and know that that's your brother or your sister, that's when the sun's come up. I thought that was a beautiful, beautiful teaching.
And with that, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for coming, Dan.
Thank you
so much for being here. And just a quick reminder that Dan's new TV special, which is also called Learning from the Heart, will be repeated on WHYY TV 12 on March 15th at 5:30 in the afternoon. And you can check our website at whyy.org for more information. Thank you.
Thanks to Mike and Dan, and we are going to have a greeting line upstairs, so if you give us about 5 minutes to get up there, we'll see you there. There are books for sale, and we have book plates that go into those. Thank you. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.